This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ الَّذِينَ صَبَرُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ أُولَئِكَ لَهُم مَّغْفِرَةٌ وَأَجْرٌ كَبِيرٌ إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: North Korea fires 10 missiles, including one that lands close to South Korea. The Palestinian Prime Minister says Netanyahu's comeback in Israel's elections prove extremism and racism are growing in the society. And Brazil's president calls for peaceful protests as demonstrators opposing election results disrupt fuel distribution. Welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The situation on the Korean Peninsula appears to be growing more unstable. South Korea has closed some of its air routes off the East Coast in response to the North firing at least 10 missiles of various types. Seoul has also launched 3 air-to-ground missiles of its own. It says for the first time, one of the missiles fired by North Korea has landed close to its waters. Another missile has come down outside Japan's exclusive economic zone. Both countries have condemned Pyongyang's missile launches. South Korea's President Yoon Suk-yeol says the move amounts to territorial invasion. Japan's defense minister, for his part, said Tokyo cannot tolerate such actions.
We will work closely with relevant countries, including the United States and South Korea, and we are determined to firmly protect our people's lives and peaceful livelihoods. Based on this situation, we will consider all options realistically without excluding anything, including counterattack capability, and continue to work on strengthening our defense capabilities fundamentally.
The U.S. and South Korea are conducting their largest ever air drills. The exercises began on Monday and will end on Friday, just hours ahead of its latest missile launches. Pyongyang called for a halt to the joint drills by Washington and Seoul, which it sees as an existential threat and proof of their hostility. From Seoul, our correspondent Frank Smith explains why the sanctions against North Korea remain a core issue in resolving the conflict.
The U.S. has suggested that they would hold so-called unconditional talks with North Korea. But one of the conditions, the primary condition of any negotiations with North Korea on the part of the U.S. and South Korea, is that the sanctions, the United Nations Security Council sanctions, really led by the United States, remain in place. And those sanctions prevent North Korea really from engaging in trade with the international community. North Korea has indicated previously it wants to see those sanctions lifted. It wants to see what it sees as a hostile policy toward Pyongyang really changed. But it hasn't seen that, despite a 2-year-long moratorium on North Korea long-range missile testing and nuclear testing. Those commitments on the part of North Korea really have elapsed now, especially with the turn and the hard line here with conservative President Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea.
Israel's former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will likely return to power as exit polls give his right-wing Likud party a narrow lead in parliamentary elections. Exit polls suggest Lee could manage to secure 61 seats in the 120-seat candidate. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Yair Lapid's party garnered only 54 seats. The right-wing firebrand Imar Ben-Gvir says, and its religious Zionism bloc has ranked third in the vote. The final results are expected later in the week and may differ from the initial results because it is still not clear if Ben-Gvir will support Netanyahu in the vote. This is Israel's first election in less than 4 years. Reacting to Israel's election results, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya said that they prove growing extremism and racism in the society. Wazal Abu Yusuf, a Palestine Liberation Organization official, also said Netanyahu's slim victory in the exit polls show Israel is becoming more rightist and extreme. We're joined by our correspondent Mona Kendall to tell us more about these recent developments. Mona, how is this recent development significant? We've heard some reactions from Palestinian officials. What will change for Palestinians? Is anything going to change for the worse? Are you expecting any changes?
Well, we have to make it clear that for the Palestinians, all the Israeli regimes are the same, or the Israeli prime ministers are the same. But maybe this time it's something different. We are speaking about Benjamin Netanyahu, and he has been Israel's prime minister for so long, for long years. Now that he was not the prime minister in the last year, so returning back to be the prime minister again would be sending a clear message to the Israelis themselves, to the settlers, that he was always the appropriate leader of the Israeli, of the Israelis, and that his strength comes from the support mainly of the Israeli settlers. So we expect that Netanyahu this time would be even worse than Netanyahu, who had to be the prime minister in the recent years, as I'm telling you, that the Israelis have tried other prime ministers. They say that anti-Israel operations continued and even rise. A number of Israeli settlers and soldiers had been killed. Israelis had been witnessing armed resistance from the Palestinians and the formation of new resistance groups. This had angered the Israeli settlers and the Israeli street in general. So if we are speaking that Netanyahu, and he's likely to be the prime minister, of course, and he would be the one to form the new Israeli cabinet. So yes, the Palestinians would be waiting even worse days with a very well-known Israeli official and personality, knowing for being very aggressive, knowing for being waiting to maybe be engaged in wars against the Palestinians, and showing the Israelis that the most important thing for him is the safety of the Israeli settlers and the Israelis in general. And this means fighting what he says is terrorism. So we would be expecting more raids to the occupied West Bank, even a widespread operation in the areas that Palestinians are being engaged in armed resistance with the Israeli soldiers, speaking about Jenin and Nablus and other areas.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Mona Kendall, joining us from Ramallah. The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran says Washington will resort to military action if necessary to prevent the Islamic Republic from obtaining nuclear weapons.
Now, there are other tools, sanctions, pressure, and yes, as the president has said, if all other means fail as a last resort, he would keep the military option very clearly on the table if that's what it would take to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon.
Mali's dialed up anti-Iran rhetoric and military threat while speaking at an event organized by an American think tank, Carnegie Endowment, clarifies that there has been no movement on Washington rejoining the Iran nuclear deal since late August, or September. He said that the U.S. will not waste time on the deal if nothing is going to happen. The 2015 deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, was left in tatters after the U.S. withdrew from it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Talks to revive the JCPOA began in April last year between Iran and the remaining signatories. However, the talks were stalled over what Iran called U.S. excessive demands. Political analyst Fadi Zadeh says the U.S. military threats against Iran or any other country is against international law.
He's an American official, so he's under the influence of American arrogance. He thinks by threatening Iran, he can achieve foreign policy goals. You know, it's actually illegal under the UN Charter to threaten other countries. The article talks about the use of force. It's illegal to use force against other countries. If the UN Security Council hasn't approved that use of force. But the sentence says threat or use of force. So threatening other countries is against international law. But we are talking about the U.S. government officials. They break international law every day. And they're showing their true face when it comes to Iran. So this is against international law. It's also against the Algiers Accord. The first article of Algiers Accord says that the U.S. Will not interfere in internal affairs of Iran. And they have been violating that accord since its beginning. And we are used to this type of American behavior in Iran, so there's nothing surprising here.
Iran has slapped sanctions on 10 American officials and 4 entities over human rights violations and supporting terrorism. Here are some of these blacklisted individuals.
General Michael Eric Kurilla, commander of U.S. Central Command. Lieutenant General Gregory Gillett, deputy commander of U.S. Central Command. Scott Dozermu, commander of U.S. Air Base in Erbil. Ann Neuberger, deputy national security advisor for cyber and emerging technology. Major General Isaac Johnson, Jr., commander of U.S. Army Civil Affairs and Psychological Operations Command.
Iran's foreign minister says that the targeted individuals and entities interfered in Iran's internal affairs, instigated violence and riots in the country, and committed economic terrorism against the Iranian nation. Those on the blacklist include U.S. Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, the CIA, and the U.S. National Guard. Over the past few weeks, the U.S. and its Western allies have imposed several rounds of sanctions on Iran over what they call a crackdown on anti-government protests. Iran dismisses the allegations, saying it was dealing with foreign-backed riots. Protesters have gathered in front of the German embassy in Tehran to denounce Berlin for what they call interference in Iran's internal affairs. Saman Kujuri reports.
A group of Iranians, among them war veterans, gathered in front of the German embassy in Tehran to protest against the German government for what they called Berlin's role in the recent riots in Iran. The protesters, including ordinary people and veterans of the eight-year Iraqi-imposed war on Iran in the 1980s, carried placards and chanted slogans against the German government for its record of supporting former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and its role in the recent unrest in Iran.
A number of my comrades and friends became handicapped and some were martyred in the war because of the enemy's chemical attacks. Documents that have been released reveal that Germany had provided Saddam with raw materials for chemical bombs. Therefore, we are to say that we do not allow Germany to interfere in the internal affairs of our country anymore. We hold Germany responsible for instigating unrest in Iran.
The demonstrators also vented their anger on the German chancellor and foreign minister.
I am taking part in this protest gathering to condemn the German government for its interventionist stance towards Iranian affairs. We know that Germany and other EU member states, by supporting riots and unrest in Iran, are only after their own vested interests, and they do not truly care about Iranian people.
On Monday, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman criticized Germany for its unconstructive initiative to classify the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps as a terrorist organization. Condemning Germany's move as an irresponsible measure, Nasser Kanani said Tehran hopes that the governments of Germany and other governments would take account of the outcome of their unconstructive measures.
Iranian officials believe that repeating such an approach by Germany and other EU member states towards Iran, which is based on miscalculations and misinformation, will once again expose the Union to failure. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Brazilian truckers and protesters supporting the outgoing President Jair Bolsonaro have blocked roads across the country, causing considerable fuel disruption and affecting food supply chains. Truckers started setting up roadblocks across the vast country soon after Bolsonaro's poll defeat to leftist rival Lula da Silva. Ports of grain export meat processing plants and slaughterhouses have been hit hard by the blockades. Many truckers benefited from lower diesel costs during the Bolsonaro administration. Bolsonaro has given a brief statement, the first since the Sunday vote. He said that the protests reflected dissatisfaction with the electoral process, but noted such protests should be peaceful. The far-right president did not concede defeat, but his chief of staff said their team would begin the process of transition to a Lula government. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says the grain shipping corridor to get food out of the country needs a reliable long-term protection. Zelensky also said Russia must realize that it will receive a harsh global response to any measures disrupting food exports. That came after Russian President Vladimir Putin called on Ukraine to guarantee the safety of Black Sea traffic. Moscow has suspended participation in a UN-brokered grain shipment deal. It cited Ukrainian drone attacks on Russian ships in Crimea. Kiev has dismissed the allegation as a false pretext. Russia has called on the UN to obtain the required guarantees from it. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah,
To thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., Senator Lindsey Graham's 15-week abortion ban bill is the first of likely many federal attempts at restricting abortion nationally. Please stay with us for more. Details of the story are given in the website salon.com. In his concurrence in Dobbs v. Jackson, Women's Health, the Supreme Court decision that overturned Roe v. Wade, Justice Brett Kavanaugh went to great pains to reassure Americans that their ability to get an abortion is not under threat. He wrote, "The court's decision today does not outlaw abortion throughout the United States." While he briefly mentions that Congress can always pass a national ban, he largely skates by that possibility to focus on how Dobbs technically does not prevent the numerous states that readily allow abortion from continuing to readily allow abortion. Implicit in Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh's argument was an assumption that so long as middle and upper class people feel they will always have access, by and large, they will not care if people who are too constrained by poverty to travel are forced into unwanted childbirth. But Kavanaugh also underestimated how determined the Christian right, through the Republican Party, is to make sure that no one outside of the very wealthy who can travel out of the country has access to abortion. As soon as it became clear that pro-choice activists were having real success protecting abortion rights in some states, and not just in blue states, but places like Kansas and Minnesota, anti-choice activists started to strategize about how to prevent people from getting abortions by simply hopping in a car or on a plane. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican, South Carolina, joined that process on Tuesday, 13th of September, unveiling what will no doubt be the first in a series of Republican bills meant to restrict abortion on a national scale. He introduced the Protecting Pain-Capable Unborn Children from Late-Term Abortions Act, a title which accomplishes the remarkable feat of including at least two lives. First, the bill would ban abortions at 15 weeks, which is approximately 13 weeks after fertilization and 11 weeks after the first missed period. No respectable doctor would call that a late-term abortion. Second, as the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists notes, the science conclusively establishes that a human fetus does not have the capacity to experience pain until after at least 24 or 25 weeks. The idea that a fetus feels pain at 15 weeks comes straight from anti-abortion propaganda and not science. Instead, the machinations behind this bill suggest that the 15-week cutoff is not about any sincere concern about pain, but a political gambit meant to move along the process of eventually banning abortion nationwide, while not intensifying the already significant voter backlash against the Republicans over this issue. Right now, Republicans are the ones who are viewed by most voters as the extremists. Republicans want to reframe this issue. Their strategy to do so involves blatant lying. Republicans repeatedly make derisible and flat-out false accusations that the pre-Dobbs legal structure allowed abortion up until the time of delivery. During the press conference announcing this bill, Senator Lindsey Graham repeated the lie, accusing Senate Democrats of wanting allow abortions up to the moment of birth. As the Kaiser Family Foundation notes, however, these scenarios do not occur, nor are they legal in the United States. Indeed, 88% of abortions are in the first 12 weeks, and those after 21 weeks are about 1% of abortions. Britain's Guardian newspaper covers the same story from a different angle. Senator Lindsey Graham proposed legislation on Tuesday, 13th of September, for a nationwide 15-week abortion ban, a politically risky strategy as a backlash grows to the U.S. Supreme Court ruling earlier this summer, overturning federal protections for the procedure. Opinion poll shows that 57% of the American public disapprove of the court's June reversal of the 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling, guaranteeing access to abortion, and 62% of the American public say the procedure should be legal in all or most cases. The proposal by Senator Graham, a hardline South Carolina Republican, will be called the Protecting Pain-Capable Unborn Children from Late-Term Abortions Act. It stands almost no chance of becoming law, but is seen by analysts as an attempt to frame the discussion around abortion with fewer than 60 days to go until midterm elections in November. The White House and top Democrats promptly decried Senator Graham's efforts. Today, Senator Graham introduced a national ban on abortion which would strip away women's rights in all 50 states. This bill is wildly out of step with what the American public wants and believes, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said in a statement. Jean-Pierre added, while President Biden and Vice President Harris are focused on historic passage of Inflation Reduction Act to reduce the cost of prescription drugs, healthcare, and energy, and to take unprecedented action to address climate change, Republicans in Congress are focused on taking rights away from millions of American women. Karine Jean-Pierre said the Biden administration and Democrats in Congress are committed to restoring the protections of Roe v. Wade. Republicans in states including South Carolina have seen recent efforts to introduce abortion bans falter, and Democrats are certain to use Senator Graham's push to fire up their base and repeat earlier warnings that their opponent's agenda has always been the pursuit of outlawing abortion nationally. Previous versions of Senator Lindsey Graham's bill have outlawed abortion after 20 weeks of pregnancy, but at a press conference on Tuesday, he was unveiling a proposed ban that takes effect after 15 weeks, an attempt to align federal law with Florida. Senator Lindsey Graham's earlier proposal contained exceptions for rape, incest, and to protect the life of the mother, which the Florida law does not. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, added to her party's protest, calling Senator Graham's proposal the latest, clearest signal of extreme MAGA Republicans' intent to criminalize women's health freedom in all 50 states and arrest doctors for providing basic health care. President Joe Biden has recently toughened his language as the midterm elections approach and Republicans put forward many right-wing candidates, decrying the so-called MAGA Republican, semi-fascist and Trumpies.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Palestinian children. The men and women of Gaza are busy piecing their lives back together, attempting bravely to cope with extensive loss of life and displacement, and thousands of innocent children suffer deep trauma every day since having their families, friends, homes, hospitals, schools, etc., deliberately, intentionally bombed by Israel with its military. The story of the suffering they experienced and continue to experience is told in the looks on their faces, full of sadness and despair, especially whenever they recall the 50 days of war they witnessed and survived in 2014. At the end of that war, the number of martyrs killed on the Palestinian side reached nearly 2,500, including 500 young children. The number of the wounded amassed to 12,000, of whom 3,300 were young children. Every child of Palestine now carries with them memories of explosions, of screams of horror, of seeing dismembered and burnt bodies, of the smell of death brought down on them by the inhumane, unconscionable actions of Israel in its efforts to oppress its occupied territory. A tank massacre here, an airstrike massacre there, is all justified by Israeli politicians and condoned by Western governments that protect these Israeli war criminals from ever facing justice in court.
This is the first time I've entered the school since the incident. It's painful and depressing for me. Inside the school, I felt my brother's presence, as if he was calling my name. He was martyred here. I also got a sense that my mother wanted me to pray for him here. The feeling is of utter sadness and grief.
Hussein and Ibrahim are standing on the ruins of the house overlooking the school in the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun. This school belongs to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. UNRWA is a UN organization. They recall back to the second day of the month of August 2014.
We are staying at the house of the late Shabab Ahmed al-Shinbari. Here there are 25 family members all living in a three-floor house, 150 square meters. The Israeli occupation forces targeted this house during its 2014 military aggression on the population of Gaza. We were evacuated quickly and headed to the UNRWA school in Beit Hanun shortly before our house was bombarded.
It was midnight when they blew a hole in our house with a tank shell about where we are sitting. We escaped to my uncle's second house, but they dropped gas bombs there. My aunt said we should prepare ourselves to go in different directions in the morning. We went to my aunt's house in Al-Gharman Street, but the Jews entered and demanded us to leave. Finally, we went to the Western School at Beit Hanun.
We moved from our home on the first day of the ground incursion mounted by Israeli forces. We went to Beit Hanun Co-ed School A and D blocks. A municipal vehicle arrived on Thursday to transport us to another school because children at Beit Hanun had been hit by shrapnel. There was a bombardment near the school where we were sheltering.
We have informed the IDF, nearly 32 times about the school, its place, who were in that school, what they are doing, and, everything, that it is should be a safe place, that you have the UN flags and the GPS had been sent to the Israeli side. The real information, in real time, we were sending them every day about everything.
Officials at the UNRWA Relief Agency in Gaza believed Israeli army assurances regarding the guaranteed safety of their accommodation centers, accordingly informing the displaced people that a school in Beit Hanun, which was sheltering hundreds of Palestinian refugees, was a safe zone. Like blood to a vampire, however, this gathering of displaced families incited the appetite of the Israeli occupation army for killing, which found easy prey. They informed the UNRWA Relief Agency and International Red Cross to evacuate the school of the displaced. The people gathered in the school yard and waited for the arrival of buses to take them somewhere safe, all of them a clear and easy target for slaughter. The Israelis rounded them up and killed 16 of them where they stood, mostly children, and wounded more than 55 others.
The Red Cross came 2 days earlier. There were 3 Red Cross vehicles and 10 Red Crescent vehicles. They announced that they came to transport the most serious cases, such as those with disabilities, the elderly, and the injured, mostly shrapnel injuries. As they took people away, we asked them what was going on, and if they thought the school was safe. They confirmed it was safe and that there was nothing to fear. We trusted that information. The UN and the Red Cross came 2 days later with buses to move more of us to the Jabalia refuge camp. People gathered in together and we all went downstairs.
My aunt was collecting laundry and about to sit and rest when the shells pounded us. Shrapnel sliced open my stomach and my intestines fell to the ground. My brother found me lying underneath my siblings. He He moved me outside and on foot he took me to the Kamal Odwan Hospital. They urgently referred me to Ash-Shifa Hospital, where I went under surgery. 10 centimeters of my intestines were cut off. Now every time I eat and when I drink water, my stomach hurts.
Five of my family were martyred, praise be to Allah. 16 other people were injured, including Manar, who lost both her legs, Ibrahim, whose intestine were reconnected, and my brother Mahmoud, who had his arteries severed.
What happened in that school, it was a real catastrophe, actually. We have tens of people that had been killed and injured in that school. The Board of Inquiry investigated, you know, what happened at Beit Hanoun school. It is a message, you know, that here in the Gaza Strip, that there is no safe place, even in a school, on the street, at your shelter, at your home, everywhere. No safe place at that time.
We don't want to stay here at the school. They forced us to come here. We don't want to be here at the school. They are all liars.
People of the world find it impossible to believe that anyone, even a Zionist occupation force, would have the audacity to bomb the accommodation centers of the United Nations. The Israeli army had orders to kill anything that moved, and this policy was exercised throughout Gaza in their ground incursion. On the 16th of July, 2014, 8 children from the Bakr family went to play on the beach of Gaza. They were kicking around a soccer ball when from Israeli military ships in the sea, missiles fired on the beach, specifically targeting the children playing.
On July 16, 2004, Ismail was sitting with his cousins. I told them that it was Ramadan and that they shouldn't be playing football and bothering the neighbors. The street is too narrow to play football. It's 2 meters wide, which is not enough room. All of us here are brothers and cousins. We live in a sector of homes the size of 1 square kilometer, which houses 1,000 people thereabouts. Ismail said he was going to play outside with his cousins. It was sunny and hot, so they went to the beach to play as they often do. It's not far, and it's the only suitable place to play, next to the part of the beach reserved for swimming.
Stay in here, son. They're shelling outside. He said he wanted to go to his uncle's house to play with their kids.
Ahid is my one and only grandson. He came after 9 granddaughters. Zakaria, my beloved son, the youngest. He was spoiled. He was my entire life.
I am accompanied by Al-Sayed, Hamada, Yunus, Ismail, Ahid, and Muhammad, and we're heading now to the spot where we used to play as kids. We are fishermen, and so the sea is our life. We are always on the sea.
The Bak family is a renowned family. We're known to be fishermen by trade. We inherited that from our fathers and from their forefathers who inherited it from Sheikh Bak. The sea is life and breath to us. When our children want to play, they go to the beach.
We set up the goals here and divided ourselves into 4 teams and we played football. The boys said they're thirsty. They wanted to go drink some water and come back. I took them to get some water and when we came back,
we resumed and finished the first round. In the middle of the second round, Ismail kicked the ball and it landed next to the container. We asked him to go get it. He brought it back, along with Mortazim, Zakaria, Ahid, and Muhammad.
The warships were there. We saw that they were filming us. They sent a missile to the beach, and it wiped out my cousin.
The first one hit Ismail.
The first missile landed there, killed my cousin Ismail, and we started running to get off the beach.
The rest of the group came running toward us. We saw them, but Ismail wasn't with them. Bashir Abu Warfa was standing there. When he heard the explosion, he came out from the tent. He stood by us while we told him that Ismail was killed. The other children reached us.
They fired a second missile, and it landed here.
We decided, Hamada, Yunus and I, to hide behind the tent. Muntasir was on the ground. They fired another missile at us as we fell behind the tent. Yunus hid in a barrel while Hamada and I kept running. Muntasir ran with us. Hamada and Muntasir entered the tent seconds after us. Bashir Abu Warfa was crying out, "O people, help us. The children are dead. The children are dead."
Four of those eight kids were basically vaporized when the bombs hit. Their young bodies could not be identified or even found amongst the debris left behind. The other four dispersed in different directions, not knowing the fate of each other, as more bombs actually followed them. Ambulances and journalists came, but it was all over.
Badly wounded, I crawled until I reached help. Someone laid me on the ground and left to bring an ambulance. They wrapped my head in a bandage and laid me down. I was in a coma, so at the time, I didn't know who was killed and who was still alive.
They laid Montasim by a wall, thinking he was dead. Hamas fainted. Yunus sat next to his brother, and I was weeping over my brother and cousins.
This other boy was with them. He came over yelling, "Mama, Mama." I said to him, "What's the matter?" He said, "Muhammad was martyred." I said, "How come Muhammad was martyred? Are you sure? You must be lying because Muhammad was here just now." He said that Muhammad was killed. I said he wasn't. But then I saw it air on TV, children killed on the beach. The girls cried. "He was our son of 20 years. We cry over you every day, son. You are never out of our thoughts."
Each day since the day Ismail was martyred, I have gone to the beach to spot where he was killed, and I've searched for his remains, hoping the sea had washed them up. I remembered that day vividly. When I reached the hospital, I realized what I had witnessed, a massacre against humanity. Where is the humanity? Ismail's senseless murder has forever taken the smile and joy from my home.
Zakaria, Ahid, and Mutasim, who was injured but thought to be dead. Ismail and all of our kids were dead. I would not wish this on anyone. Everyone saw us on TVs and internet. What can I possibly say? I say occupation took my first grandson, who called me grandma.
The survivors of that tragic day come back to the beach, not to play as they did before, but to sit, to remember, vainly searching for a rational reason to an irrational act. It was a blatant war crime, which claimed the lives of their four relatives, with no one thus far held accountable. Meanwhile, they suffer from physical injuries themselves and the psychological trauma of it all.
Life without them is meaningless and full of despair. I'm not saying that because they are my brothers, but for the sake of all Palestinians, all of children.
I'm If I was flying a jet and I saw Jewish children playing, I wouldn't target them because they are just children playing. They could see from after that we were children.
They could tell we were a bunch of kids playing. They deliberately target and kill the children of Gaza and Palestine. They want to uproot them at a young age so they won't grow up and become resistors. So they bomb them at this young age.
Incredibly, shockingly, the targeting of Palestinian children escalated and peaked on the day of Eid al-Fitr, when the children of Gaza came out to play, to lighten up, relax, and have some fun to celebrate the last day of Eid, thinking that the Israeli army would not dare to violate such a holy occasion. Israel unmercifully sent missiles down, turning their brief period of joy to incomprehensible grief.
We live in Al-Ahrar Street at the beach camp, a major street in the camp area. We awoke on the day of Eid to enjoy it like everyone else normally does. The children were playing in the street, some were playing on the swings. All of a sudden, a missile landed on top of us. It was around 3 p.m. We were surprised by the explosion, but when we turned around, we saw the children had become shreds of flesh laying in the street. Some were injured and some others were dead.
I was playing on the swings when the missile landed. I got hit with shrapnel here. Some people were killed. My uncle Shaban, Jamal, and Muhammad were among those who died. I remember we were happy and playing on the day of Eid. Who could be so wicked as to bomb us on such a holy day? The children were out playing and rejoicing. And then the missile came, and in a second they were dead. Shaban had been blown apart. Others who died were Muhammad al-Halu, the Barid family's son, Muhammad Miqdad, and Muhammad Washah.
Muhammad Miqdad, Muhammad Washah.
كان في كثير شهداء مرميين.
There were many martyrs, some scattered around on the ground, inside buildings, in trees, everywhere. The injured and the dead. Ambulances and cars swarmed on the location, and people were crying out in anguish for the loss of their children. 13 martyrs and 40 to 50 injuries. I sustained injuries to my leg here. And in my chest here.
My son was playing behind the car. He was almost next to me, but he died due to bleeding caused by a shrapnel penetrating his body. When the missile first landed, I was still conscious, receiving wounds to my stomach, legs, and arms. My leg disabled and my arm was broken and behind my back. I wore a white top which was covered in blood. I looked around just before I fainted to see the extent of the brutality and carnage. The scene was horrific, their actions so brutal.
Martyrs came from several refugee families at the beach camp on the first day of Eid after being targeted by an Israeli bombing campaign. On the third day of Eid, missiles of the Israeli occupation forces targeted some little kids who were playing with their grandfather with some simple new toys they had received for Eid on the roof of their home.
A truce was declared on television on the third day of Eid. We went up on the roof with all the little children. They wanted to play because it was a time of truce. They were not allowed to go out in the street because we worried about their safety.
بعد صلاة العصر حوالي بنص ساعة ساعة إلا ربع
After 30 to 45 minutes of afternoon prayer, we heard more explosions. There was a first, second, and third explosion. It took some minutes to work out what had happened. Our house was filled with heavy smoke, and we realized that it was actually our house that had been bombed by an Israeli airstrike.
We rushed to the roof only to see the most horrifying scene. All that remained of the elderly man and the seven children that were playing were pieces of flesh and bone. At least three had their heads blown off. I looked over the martyred children. Two of my daughters were among the victims. One had survived. She had a hole in the back of her skull. Another girl was also alive, but couldn't talk. I called her and she looked up at me, so I rushed them to the hospital.
I searched around to collect my children. First, I took Abd al-Halim, then I went back inside and got Abd al-Aziz. His head had been split open. I couldn't remove my third daughter. I couldn't find her head. Then I came downstairs and stood here at the doorstep. They took away the bodies of the martyrs in ambulances. I wanted to see whether they took the body of my daughter or not. I found my niece Malik, the daughter of Jalal. I kissed her forehead and I was about to leave with the ambulance. As I was stepping out of the ambulance, a rocket from an unmanned drone hit us. My leg was hit and had to be amputated. This finger and my arm were injured too. It was a cruel airstrike. In all, there were 10 martyrs from my family, including seven children, my parents, my brother and his daughter, and my cousin who was carrying the bodies of martyrs at the time he was hit.
After the disproportionate aggression on the population of Gaza, there are still survivors today who suffer heightened psychological effects, reflected clearly in their behavior, which is especially telling during play activities such as painting that express the evil acts that Israel perpetrated against them.
Usually after the therapy process and even after recovery, there will still be some trauma symptoms among the affected children, with most of them on edge, in high alert mode, expecting more attacks on them. That's why you find that whenever a child is playing or drawing, the played-out theme tends to represent the incident, which is causing the alerted state from their memories, from their nightmares. When we spoke to children aged around 12 who survived the last three wars, who witnessed and suffered trauma from the 2008 Israeli-imposed war and this one in 2014, after recovering from each war and after being treated, they still believe that there would be another war and another. Three wars lived through by a child. The trauma is unimaginable, and the child is left in a state of constant alertness. We can't even tell them that they are safe, that there will be no more wars, or that everything is now fine.
Whenever they unleash a war on us, we will resist and defeat them.
It is beyond any reasonable doubt that targeting children of Palestine is part of the culture and a systematic issue of the Israeli occupation army, which seeks to brand the conscious mind of all Palestinian children with the ideology that they are all the undeserved, the subhuman, that there can be no Palestinian flag, no independence, no resistance.
In the Limelight.
Now some countries and some international cooperation platforms have begun to coordinate attempts to de-dollarization, such as BRICS. In the context of the weakening U.S. dollar hegemony, developing countries all over the world need a more stable type of financial mechanism as a new channel for conducting financial transactions. The BRICS and other international platforms are trying to work out solutions. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT in a report wrote, the two nations have been promoting settlements in national currencies, referring to Russia and China. The transition to trade in national currencies between Russia and China will contribute to a global de-dollarization process. China's charged offer in Russia said this week at a conference on Russian-Chinese relations. Sun Weidong said, noting that bilateral trade has risen dramatically, mostly on energy and agricultural supplies, the existing economic partnership between China and Russia and the long-term accumulated level of trade have laid a solid foundation for further deepening cooperation between our countries. Energy cooperation continues to play an important role in relations between the two countries. In addition, agricultural products and seafood from Russia are increasingly entering the Chinese market, the diplomat said, adding, we have cooperation on major projects in the field of nuclear energy, aircraft construction, rocket engines, satellite navigation. In addition, payments are constantly being made in local currencies. Russia and its trading partners have been expanding the share of national currencies in mutual settlements in an attempt to move away from the US dollar and the euro. In recent years, Moscow has been steadily following a policy of de-dollarization of foreign trade, particularly